Welcome back to Bitcoin for Advisors. I'm your host, Morgan Rochard. And with me, I have the assistant to the host, Pierre Rochard.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I'm glad you made it.
I made it this time, yeah.
We were out last month because we went to Pacific Bitcoin, and we wanted to actually record this on the road because we were going to talk about FTX today, but we just, we didn't get it together. So, but that means that we will have a jam-packed episode of all sorts of information because so much more has come out since Pacific Bitcoin. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a great conference. So thank you to the Swan team for hosting that and inviting us to come speak. Morgan did an excellent workshop on Bitcoin financial planning.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was sort of shocked that I was able to fill 2 hours on a soapbox about financial planning, but here we are.
I was not shocked. I know that you can talk a while.
I could talk uninterrupted for 2 hours about financial planning. It was great. The conference, honestly, I thought it was really well put on. And it was intimate, but also large enough where people could meet lots of different people. So, the seating was really great, how they had it. The lighting was cool. They even had some basketball stuff happening outside, which was awesome. So, yeah, I would give it 2 thumbs up, would go again.
Same. Absolutely. And everyone was talking about FTX.
Yeah. So I think that was kind of the coolest part of it, was that this was all unfolding while we were at Pacific Bitcoin. And if it were a crypto conference, obviously it would have been really quite a downer. But the vibe we got there was definitely not. People were like, you know, they're having a ball. And
feeling a little bit vindicated.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah.
All the Bitcoin maxis yelling from the rooftops about self-custody are finally feeling like, I'm right.
Well, it's interesting because self-custody often gets portrayed as a philosophical or ideological thing of, oh, you know, if you're a purist, you think you should hold your own keys. But I actually see it as a very pragmatic thing of, if you want to manage your risk and minimize your uncertainty, you should hold your own keys. And it's not like, even before FTX, it was not a hypothetical, what if something were to happen to a custodian? Like, when I was growing up in Bitcoin, Mt. Gox happened, mm-hmm. Right? Like, it wasn't like a theoretical statement that, hey, if you leave your money at an exchange, it could disappear overnight. It was that we've seen this happen firsthand, not just Mt. Gox, many others, but I think the big one before FTX was Mt. Gox. And now we've seen it happen, not just with FTX, but also with the likes of BlockFi and Voyager and Celsius.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really similar to Mt. Gox too, because if anyone recalls what happened back then, Roger Ver actually looked at Mt. Gox's financials or something. Bank account statements, yeah. Or whatever. He didn't really know what he was looking at, and he said that they were solvent. And I think it kind of ties in really well with what's gone on with FTX, because there were all these big players that invested who you would think would have done some sort of due diligence. And it seems like they did cursory due diligence equivalent to that of what Roger Ver did. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I come from a background of auditing. I got my master's in financial accounting. And so I feel very strongly about this topic. And I think that one of the problems it's kind of driven by the 0% interest rate, which is all sorts of free money, lots of capital going into VCs. And then the VCs end up competing on how little due diligence they do, because the entrepreneurs, understandably so, they don't want to have to deal with a third party auditing their financials, even if they're clean, mm-hmm. Right? Because it's just inconvenient. You've got somebody in your business, and it feels like it's a waste of your time when you should be focused on operating your business. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that even in situations where it's a good actor, the company is doing the right thing. But the reality is that it is 100% necessary when anyone's going to make an investment with anyone else, I think that they should have a proper financial audit following the auditing standards and accounting standards of whatever jurisdiction they're in. And to me, it's like table stakes. That's like the bare minimum.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's like not just that, obviously, that you have to do, to make an investment.
That's like, okay, now you have audited financial statements that we can look at, right? Now we go on to step number two, which is we're going to evaluate the accounting statements that have been prepared. And in the auditing profession, there is a view that, well, not just a view, but a recognition that there is what's called the expectations gap. And the expectations gap is, what do public company investors think they are getting with a financial audit versus what is the auditor actually performing and what assurances is the auditor actually providing? Because I think the expectation that investors have is an unrealistic one, that essentially the auditors are performing an x-ray of the company. Mm-hmm. And if there's a broken bone, they'll be able to immediately identify it, right? That would be like a radiologist would just obviously see that there's a broken bone there.
They think that there's some sort of forensic accounting / investment analysis happening from the auditor.
Right.
Yeah, which is just not true.
It's not true. They are, because there are limits to what they can do, the auditing standards just ask them to, you can just take your headphones off. The auditing standards just ask them to take a sample of the data, and that way they can see if, within that sample, if there's anything to pull on, a thread to pull on. That's that was always what we were told in auditing classes, like, you want to try to find threads to pull on. So if you pull up an invoice and there's an itemized thing on there that is non-descriptive, that's an interesting thread to pull on, right? If it just says services rendered, okay, well, why didn't they specify what services were rendered? Maybe this is, some kind of invoice fraud going on. But the purpose of the audit is not to try to find all the fraud that's going on at the company. That's something different. So, all this to point out that the VC industry is not incentivized to perform enhanced due diligence on companies, and that is particularly problematic when the VC is financing an entity like FTX, where the retail public is being asked to send their money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, if we think back to how VCs started to begin with, right, it was literally seed round funding for these companies where people were operating out of their garage and they had no money to do so. And so they would basically ask in exchange, for 10, 15, 45% of their company for some money. And so the due diligence is a little different when you're operating in that regard, rather than giving seed round funding to something like an exchange where people are going to keep funds there. But the same principles for VCs apply. They don't change the way that they do their quote unquote due diligence just based on what the company is providing, unfortunately.
Right. And the downside, for example, let's take the Apple. So when a VC is investing in a company like Apple, the risk for the retail public is that they buy a computer that doesn't work, right? That's a lemon.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, so, very, very limited downside. And it's also something that, so now if a VC was financing a new bank where people are expected to put their life savings, now the downside risk is far greater.
Yeah, in which case due diligence should increase.
Well, not necessarily from the VC's perspective, because their downside is still the same.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
But the public, when they look at, oh, this very reputable VC is financing this bank, they think that, all right, well, now the VC's reputation is on the line, and now their capital is at risk, and so this is fine. What they don't see is that from the VC's perspective, that investment is a small piece of their portfolio, mm-hmm. and they expect most of their portfolio to go to zero, and then a small percentage of their portfolio to have outsized returns that makes the fund.
Yep.
And that doesn't work if we're talking about an expectations gap, like this is the widest gap imaginable, where the VC is saying, hey, odds are this financial institution is going to fail. And mm-hmm. I'm going to be wiped out. I'm going to have zero, but that's okay. I'm managing my risk in my portfolio. But the depositor has put their entire life savings into this one financial institution.
Yep.
And now they are a creditor in a multi-jurisdiction bankruptcy.
I think it gets particularly bad, too, because like when multiple VCs and prominent names start investing in the same one, then it gives the bank or institution or exchange more credibility than it otherwise would have from the public's point of view, even though the same amount of due diligence is being done. And you would think that at some point somebody would have done more due diligence, right? That's, I guess, the hope of the public is that when that many people are involved, somebody must have done some due diligence, right? But in the case of FTX, that seems to not have happened at all.
Right. Now, I think that, the amount of like bandwagon groupthink in the investing world has been amplified by this easy money.
Oh, for policy. Sure. For sure. Yeah.
And also I'd say that the desire to, you know, I don't think this applies so much in this scenario, but to minimize costs, right? That, oh, okay, well, now we're going to do like passive investing. Like the purpose of VC is that they should be the most active and be. And they're like, well, you know, we're investing in risky businesses, but they shouldn't be investing in fraudulent businesses.
Yeah, there's a difference between taking risk and really investing in outright scams, right? I mean, you can, and I think that a lot of VCs have hidden behind this of like, oh, well, we just took some risk on this. But there's a difference between you take a risk on a company and it just, you know, things happen and the company goes out of business, which is the expectation for most of what they invest in, and versus like, we invested in this business and they outright stole customer deposits and decided to do whatever they wanted with them. And it's completely unrecoverable.
That's right. So I really think that to the extent that there was tremendous negligence on the part of VCs financing this, they hold some responsibility here. We'll see how it bears out, but so I think just to rewind here, okay, because we're really knocking the VCs hard, but really, who needs to be knocked hard here is FTX.
We went a little off the rails.
Yeah. we were talking about the importance of auditing, which I also, not only do I look at it from my background as an auditor, but I also look at it from my background as a Bitcoiner. And as a Bitcoiner, when you're buying Bitcoin and you're running a Bitcoin node, that allows you to have basically the financial statements of the entire network that you are, quote unquote, investing in, rather saving money in. I think that the VCs who are investing in crypto and in FTX, they have not gone full Bitcoiner. They have not fully digested the orange pill, because they still are not scrutinizing the world through the lens of don't trust, verify.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Like, they haven't internalized the ethos. And yet they're like, no, I understand Bitcoin, but I'm interested in all this other stuff. And it's like,
I think it makes sense, though, if you think about how VCs fund. They fund based on a story. Right? Like the story for Bitcoin is I think for the most part started as being really appealing for a bunch of, you know, ragtag libertarians who wanted their money to be separated from state. I think it's becoming extremely obvious for the average person why something like this would be important given the backdrop that we're currently living in. But I think from a VC standpoint, right, the story is not as compelling as, like, you know, some guy down the block who created some interesting smart contract that could have a unicorn on it and whatever else they think is excited to invest. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm just kind of blowing something out of my mouth here, but like, the story has always been important to VCs, and the way they craft stories, it helps the public get invested in things that they otherwise wouldn't. And I think it's been particularly dangerous in crypto because VCs get the pre-mine, so they get invested first, and then they start telling the story, and they help with the marketing and everything else for these companies that are nothing. And then the public gets to basically hold the bags of the VCs after they hear the story that's been really well-crafted. And so I think, like, in some ways, it used to be fine when it wasn't so easy for the public to invest in something like this, you know, where they would craft these stories and they had these whatever they were going to do with their own portfolios. But now that the retail public is so heavily involved, it seems just outright fraudulent to me what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. We could unpack what we know about FTX so far.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
That this was an exchange that was founded by traders for traders.
Ooh.
Which, yeah. I've worked at an exchange at Kraken. I think that exchanges should sell their product to the correct audience, which is traders.
Mm-hmm.
And that I don't have a problem with that. The problem, I think, with FTX was that they were not selling their product only to traders. They were also selling it to the retail public.
Yep.
Who I would generally, like, I don't think that we should be trying to turn the retail public into traders.
Oh, definitely not. Yeah. But that's basically what every VC product that's come out, that's what Robinhood is, trying to turn the public into traders by making trading free and exciting and easy to do on an app, as opposed to having to sit at your desk.
Yeah.
And everything, like all the app trading, I would say, has come from that for sure. So it seems par for the course that something like this would come out for crypto.
Because essentially what they're trying to sell it as is like, it's like fantasy football, except with tokens or stocks or, you know, I think it's gambling, but they want to sell you on the idea that it's positive expected value, right? Because ultimately there's some kind of growth story behind these assets.
I do think it gets at the heart of like the true problem though with 0% interest rates and fiat money though, right? Is that you do need to quote unquote put your money to work, right? And so people are trying to find a way to keep ahead of inflation, to keep ahead, to be able to manage their expenses and have the lifestyle that they covet, that, like, because we live in a very materialistic environment. So it really plays into, I think it plays into what the average average person is experiencing in the current economy, of like, you know, sports betting is maybe not as up and up these days as, or, you know, you can't bet on a jockey the way that maybe you can go just to the crypto exchange, right? It's a little bit easier. It's a little bit more sexy to talk about with your friends. Yeah. Sorry, I'm interrupting you, but.
No. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree with that. And their Super Bowl commercial was like, Larry David being a curmudgeon, who is, you know, doesn't believe in any new technology. He's a Luddite, and that he should have FOMO, right? That he should have fear of missing out mm-hmm. on this new wave of innovation. That
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I thought it was kind of a mediocre commercial.
Mm-hmm.
But. Humorous nonetheless, because I think Larry David's pretty funny.
Yeah, me too. Side note, I loved Larry David's COVID commercial, even though I don't really necessarily agree with it, but he was like, why would you leave the house?
Yeah.
Everything bad happens when you leave the house. Just stay home.
Yeah, yeah. Turns out he was wrong about that,
yeah.
But he was right about FTX, yeah. And being skeptical of FTX. So yeah, they brought in people who really had no business, you know, getting invested in this stuff. And it seems like the way they were able to even afford this level of marketing was by stealing customer money.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So it really is kind of the pure Ponzi that I think goes beyond Madoff, because it's interesting how much money and Madoff victims were able to recover from that Ponzi. If I recall correctly, it was like 50 to 75 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, well, because I think his Ponzi is a little more like Social Security. There was a reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas with FTX, like, and Madoff had a low cost of customer acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He right. wasn't like doing Super Bowl commercials.
No, he'd have breakfast with them in Palm Beach. Like, yes. That's not.
And he was going to do that anyways. So yeah. He got to like expense his meal. Yeah.
50% if the IRS.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Whereas SBF, he was like not just buying Super Bowl commercials, but also buying like magazine covers.
Yes, yeah. We saw plenty of those with his name on it.
And I thought it was really bizarre when he was not just the magazine covers, but like giant posters with, frankly, his unaesthetic body and face and hair.
The bizarre thing about him to me was the fact that we've been doing this for almost 10 years together. Right, you've been in it longer than me, but we've been in this for almost 10 years together, and I'd never heard of this person until, like, last year sometime. I mean, that to me was just like, how did this person out of the blue become somebody that we should randomly, you know, care about that is all of a sudden, like, on the world stage, quote-unquote, all over magazines? It just seemed...
Yeah, and the explanation was like, they made lots of money off of this one trade arbitraging between Asia and the U.S. and Bitcoin, and... Whenever I heard or read that story, like, obviously my mind was like, I'd like to run the numbers on that.
Yeah.
that sounds made up. But, you know, with these prop trading firms, you can't run the numbers on it. It's a privately held company.
Sometimes they can't even run the numbers on it.
No, and that's some of the reporting that came out was that their record keeping was a mess. And when I hear that, like we were talking about strings to pull on earlier, mm-hmm. that is a full fire alarm, you know, emergency.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's more than red flags. That's like sirens and bullhorns.
Well, I have to say, though, it is an issue generally that we've seen just like coming from the traditional financial services place. It's like when we deal with these exchanges, you know, like exchanges that are on the up and up, like Coinbase, for instance, is, you know, publicly traded and audited. I'm not saying that means leave your coins at Coinbase, but, you know, like that's a better example of like, you know, people who are generally doing something right. Like, we still have issues with the accounting over at Coinbase. And so they're the ones that are, quote unquote, doing it right, right? That they're a publicly traded company, they're able to be that and so forth. So that I think that gives you sort of an eye into how publicly audited financial statements don't necessarily mean that the product itself is perfect, right, and everything else. But to then, to compare that to, let's say, you know, statements I got over it when I was at Goldman Sachs, or like statements I get regularly from my clients at TD Ameritrade. I mean, the accounting is just, there's just no comparison between what we get at these, you know, old fashioned financial institutions that, you know, people in crypto want to do away with versus what's going on in these newer institutions. And it's really because the products are led by engineers and not being really managed by anyone who knows a thing about financial services, or at least started that way, right? Things are getting better, obviously. So, like, it makes 100% sense to me that they would start this exchange and then they wouldn't create any sort of accounting system for their own trading and so forth, and it would be a complete disaster over there.
Yes. And I worked at a high-frequency trading firm, and I did a lot of fund accounting there, which was doing reconciliations with brokers. And if there were no mistakes in those reconciliations, you could ask the question of, why are we doing it?
Mm-hmm.
There were always little things that were off that we had to follow up on. Mm-hmm. And this was the cream of the crop. This was the top, right, of finance. And this was kind of, you know, the height of automation and of, but we would still be emailing PDFs, you know, Excel files and whatnot. So I think that in terms of record keeping and auditing, there part of it is a lack of maturity. I think another part of it is it's good if you are committing a fraud.
Oh, yeah.
To not do any of that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like, how can anyone know that you're committing fraud if they can't even figure out, like, anything about the books?
And the other thing, too, is that, like, if you're not a classically trained accountant, people, like, I feel this way about finance people. No offense.
But oh, it's fine. Yeah, we suck.
When I have conversations with finance people, and they'll talk about capital. Okay, we got capital to do this, do that. I'm like, are you talking about you have cash on your balance sheet, or are you talking about you have equity, right? Of like net asset, you know, like assets.
We're
minus
notoriously
liabilities.
Guilty of this, yeah. Yeah, because we're not accountants, so we don't know what you're talking about,
right? Yeah. Or they'll talk about like net revenue, and I'm like, okay, are you talking about net income,
yeah,
or
after COGS?
Yeah,
I get confused about that too, because so we deal sometimes with people's bookkeepers, like clients' bookkeepers, and we'll ask them to send over a P&L, and then they send over this thing, and I'm just like, are you a bookkeeper? Like, yeah. Are you supposed to know accounting? Why can't I read this? So yeah, I hear you 100%.
It's like this, like, fuzzy thinking, and every time I hear SBF talking, I'm reminded of these conversations I've had at times in my career with finance people who know enough to get themselves in trouble.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I think also with SBF, it seemed obvious from his interviews that he, like, exactly what you're saying, that he knew enough to get himself in trouble, but he was very good at crafting things with buzzwords and other, in a way where he really wouldn't say much of anything. I noticed that on a lot of his interviews where he would talk and he would be talking for 5-6 minutes straight and he wouldn't actually say anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then one interview, he said that he was only focused on revenue, top line revenue, and that he wasn't paying attention to his balance sheet. Which, and you know, it's I've seen it at startups, at other companies as well, of this focus on top line revenue, because the idea being that that's what investors care about is revenue growth. And for example, with Amazon, right? They'll say, you know, what matters is revenue, not net profit, because they can turn on net profit whenever they want to. They can, you know, raise prices, and that will prove. And they've done this like on some quarters. Well, they'll turn that on so that to prove to the market that they have pricing power, but that right now they're just trying to maximize revenue growth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other vanity metrics as well of like, you know, getting more users onto your platform and things like that, where
yeah,
you're not really talking about what's the long-term value?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, a profitable business has net income, positive net income, right? I mean, truly, at the end of the day, that's what makes a business something that's worth even purchasing. So it just seems like we've gotten caught up in this revenue growth. I think, really, it's kind of a function of Amazon, to be honest.
Yeah.
I would say, like, Amazon sort of started this of, like, well, we're going to focus on revenue, and if that means that we, you know, we make no money or we have a loss, like, at least we could show how much revenue growth we have, and eventually we'll be able to turn this into a business that makes money. And we're still kind of waiting for that. I feel like, I mean, in some extent, they're making more than they used to, obviously, right? But they've had massive, massive revenue growth, and they've basically become the place where people buy everything. And so I think, like, VCs, especially in small, like, businesses that are starting out, something like FTX, they, like, they get really excited about something like that. But like we're dealing with this with a client where they had massive revenue growth, but net income is just not there. And so like now it's time to go sell this business. We can't sell it because there's nothing to sell, right? If you, the business doesn't make any money, it doesn't matter how much revenue you have. It's just a headache.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's worse is if you're not paying attention to your balance sheet.
Yeah.
Now, to me, when SBF is like, I wasn't paying attention to my balance sheet, it's like, well, first of all, client money is not on your balance sheet.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's not your balance sheet. That's their balance sheet. Mm-hmm. And I find it appalling when, you know, that in any, including banks, like it's funny because people are going after SBF for using client money to make investments. It's like, that's what fractional reserve banks do all day. So now, granted, that's not what they do from a legal perspective, right? From a legal perspective, when you deposit your dollars at a JP Morgan Chase, you're lending those dollars to JP Morgan Chase. That's what the contract is. Mm-hmm. With FTX, from what we can tell from the terms of service, you were not lending your Bitcoin to them. You were depositing it there in essentially a segregated account where it's one for one backed by Bitcoin on their private keys. And this is where it's like, okay, now that might be true from a legal perspective that the terms of service are 100% reserve, you know, Bitcoin backed banking. But from the Bitcoin network perspective, it's always not your keys, not your Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And so, in a sense, you're always lending your Bitcoin when you're giving it to somebody else. Yeah. And I would say it's worse. You're always donating your Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
When you send it to somebody else.
Yeah. Well, you made this point about proof of reserve, which I really liked, which was like, so best case scenario is how Stack and Sats does it, where they have basically segregated addresses where you can see proof of reserve. But it doesn't change the fact that like all you can do is check it or move your coins off. But the second that, you know, not that Stack and Sats is going to do that, but the second that they go and sweep customer funds, which they can do, now you don't have proof of reserves. Obviously, you can see that a fraud happened, right? You can see it in real time that the fraud happened, but it doesn't change the fact that the fraud happened. So, like, really, truly, not your keys, not your Bitcoin applies no matter, like, whether or not proof of reserves is there and so forth.
That's right. And a business can go into bankruptcy for reasons completely unrelated to their custodying of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Bitcoin might still be there, but now they're locked up in a bankruptcy process.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's part of the story at Mt. Gox is like there are Bitcoin there. They just have been caught up in this bankruptcy process and we're now close to a decade.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Forced hodling, as it's been called. Yeah.
Well, it's also, though, like it's an unpleasant reminder, too. I mean, I don't know if anyone's been on the receiving end of these, especially during the financial crisis in 2008, where things started going bankrupt, where you would then get notices about things being bankrupt. But it's not like as soon as something goes bankrupt, the security leaves your account. Generally, the security is then there. There's bankruptcy proceedings. There's usually court cases and other things, lawsuits that are happening where people are trying to recover money in the midst of the bankruptcy. So in the meantime, you're holding this security, which you can see is impaired on your statement. You are getting letters constantly reminding you about your terrible investment. And then it, you know, it takes anywhere between 3 to 15 years for it to get sorted out. So it's just like a constant reminder, really, that you did the wrong thing. So the best way to make sure that doesn't happen to you and your Bitcoin would be just after you buy it, you move it off exchange.
That's right. And it's funny because people will be like, oh, Pierre, I can't do that. I have to leave my Bitcoin at the exchange so that I can trade. I'm like, stop trading.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I also don't think you should be trading. So, and same thing with kind of the lending and borrowing side of things. It's like, if you don't engage in those activities, like there's no need there's no need to be trading. Mm-hmm. It's not a need you have. It's a want, right? It's a desire. It's a gambling habit. It's not like water, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't help your long-term financial situation.
No. And if you need a hobby, there are many hobbies that don't involve you leaving your Bitcoin with a third party, right? Like, go to Michael's, go to a hobby store.
Hobby Lobby.
Go to Hobby Lobby, go to Best Buy, find yourself.
Organize your child's Legos.
Organize your child's Legos. do anything that, you know, does not involve, you know, leaving your Bitcoin as a third party. Because even, you know, people will say like, oh, this vindicates DeFi. Because with DeFi, it's transparent and you're holding your own keys, you know, with this decentralized protocol. And it's like, I find that it's a way of being like, instead of getting liquidated or losing value in a convoluted bankruptcy process, don't you want to get liquidated in an automated manner transparently on the blockchain? It's like, I don't want to get liquidated at all. Like, you're not solving the underlying problem. You're just treating the symptom.
Totally. I couldn't agree more.
It's like, okay, don't you want to trade altcoins and lose money automatically, you know, with
well,
a smart contract?
Well, that's kind of how I feel like with staking. It's like, oh, I'm going to opt into diluting myself with staking.
Yeah.
Sure, that sounds great.
I mean, at least
I'm transparently being diluted.
and paying taxes.
Yeah, and paying taxes at the same time. It's great.
Yeah, and potentially even trusting a third party with my asset while they do the staking for me, because
kind
it's
of sounds
hard
like
to do
dollars.
Yeah. Sadly.
To get back to FTX, though.
To get back to FTX. Yeah, so, you know, it's amazing how the more I heard about it, the more Ponzi's were packed into this story. Mm-hmm.
Give some highlights. Yeah.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, a couple more Ponzi's. One was they were putting money into Alameda, which is this hedge fund of SBFs that, you know, was the traders that they were previously to starting FTX. But anyway, putting money into Alameda, not to trade or to be a market maker, but to go out and make VC investments. And so then they would invest in some Web3 token project, and they would tell that token project, okay, now you have to leave your money at FTX.
Ugh.
That we just invested into you. So it's just like a perfect circular loop of
we VC. Give you money, you give it back to us, and then we seize the deposits.
Yeah, and then we invest it in another project, right? It's really a beautiful flywheel of, Now, then the other Ponzi was the trader Ponzi.
The trader Ponzi. This is a good one.
Yeah. Alameda was making a market on FTX, but they were reliably losing money on their market making. And where was that money going? It was going to counterparties on those trades, which were other market makers, other traders on this platform. And so they were making lots of money on FTX, and they were like, wow, we're making more money on FTX than we are on, let's say, Coinbase. Let's move more capital to FTX. Now, how is Alameda financing their losses? Well, using deposits from traders at FTX.
Yeah.
And so it was just a bonkers circular Ponzi that was, you know, just exceedingly efficient in its circularity. I've never seen so many nested Ponzi's.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing how they came up with these little loops.
Yeah,
for
I mean,
people
so
to enter into.
People are like, "Oh, you know, like $30 billion were lost." I'm like, "Yeah, but how much money was actually lost. Mm-hmm. If we remove all the circularity here, are we talking about like $500 million that was multiplied into $30 billion? But well, I guess that's for the bankruptcy CEO to unwind.
I mean, they have a lot of accounting to unwind, I would imagine, to figure that out.
Or very little accounting.
Or very little, yeah. Who knows? Yeah. It was actually $1 that was being passed around.
Yeah. 30 billion times.
Yeah.
But we don't know because there's no accounting records. Yeah, so it's all just ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Yeah. It also, didn't they pay fines to the SEC with customer deposits?
Oh, that was BlockFi.
Oh, that was BlockFi. Yeah. Okay, sorry, I'm getting them mixed up.
BlockFi was fined for issuing an unregistered security, and I think it was like $150 million. But it's not like it was paid out of, you know, the CEO's personal bank account. Mm-hmm. No, it was paid out from depositors.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's funny because it's not funny, obviously. But when the SEC does these fines, they're usually doing them, they're directing them at companies that, like, you know, they're large banks or whatever that can actually afford to pay these large fines out of their regular cash flow. They're not actually seizing customer deposits to do so. So it's kind of interesting that in trying to protect investors from investing in an unregistered security, they inadvertently got everyone's deposits seized.
Yeah. And this was something that I found really bizarre in my, I took a graduate finance law class when we were talking about the SEC. It's like, who are the victims? Because in my mind, the purpose of the judicial system of justice is, in the case of financial fraud, to try to make the victims whole, mm-hmm. one, right? And two, to punish the criminals.
Yeah.
Now, punish the criminals, in my mind, is they go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they have money, it should be going to number one, which is making the victims whole.
Yeah.
If they don't have money, then they go to jail.
Yeah.
But if they have money and they make the victims whole, then I don't necessarily think they should go to jail for very long,
mm-hmm.
because like the victims were made whole. And so are they really victims other than they had to waste time?
Yeah. Well, it seems like in the case of an unregistered security where you're trying to protect investors, the right thing would say, okay, you can't operate this unregistered security anymore.
It's a cease and desist.
Yep. And then they just have to make everybody basically withdraw.
Yeah.
They have a timetable and people have to get out by a certain date and that's it.
100%.
Yeah.
And if they can't make them whole, then at that point it becomes a criminal matter.
Yep.
Of, okay, well, now you have to go to jail because you did this. But if you do make them whole, then it's like, all right, you did the wrong thing here, but at least nobody lost money. Maybe you're barred from the securities industry for, you know, 10 years or whatever.
But in this case, the government feels like the injured party because their laws weren't followed.
Yeah.
So they deserve to get their those customer deposits.
They were offended.
They were a victim.
Yeah, they were a victim of BlockFi because BlockFi did not follow their law on this. That part of, and they are, the SEC is victimizing BlockFi depositors,
mm-hmm.
right? I think the SEC should have to give that money back.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
To make the BlockFi depositors whole. I mean, that would be justice. If they don't, I mean, they, in my mind, are as responsible, as guilty as BlockFi itself.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree, 100%.
And furthermore, if the SEC is going to put itself out there as, we're protecting investors, then it creates a positive obligation of when investors lose money, the SEC has a responsibility to make them whole. Because they were telling people, hey, look, like if we don't detect the fraud and if we don't catch the bad actors and take care of things, then we'll like they're defrauding the public,
mm-hmm.
right? And I find it like either get out of the way and say, hey, look, buyer beware, you've got to do your own due diligence. Nobody here is looking out for you. It's on you. And we disband the SEC and we get rid of it. or they have to take their obligations to the public seriously.
Yeah.
Because right now, like, we're in what I would call anarcho-tyranny. The anarcho part is they don't enforce the laws on FTX and BlockFi and Voyager, etc. And the tyranny part is that they go after Kim Kardashian for doing an advertisement for Ethereum Max, you know, some scam coin. It's like, which is like a completely inconsequential part of the market.
Mm-hmm. I was going to call it no man's land where the retail investor gets shot, but yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, obviously, I'd love to get rid of the SEC, but I feel like we're not headed in that direction. Based on the CFTC hearings and everything else that's been coming out, it sounds like we're heading in the worst direction where they get more money.
Yeah, and their idea is, oh, we need to go through all these tokens and we need to figure out which ones are commodities and which ones are securities. And to me, that's so besides the point of what happened here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just, it's irrelevant.
Well, because imagine if after Madoff, they were like, okay, we need to go through equity options trading and decide whether or not we're going to allow collared strategies anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just like, but that's not, he claimed he had a collared strategy, but he actually stole customer deposits. Like, what are we talking about here? Like, it's just, there was outright fraud. And the fact that, I mean, I don't even understand why the media is like complicit in all of this for whatever reason, why they're trying to cover this up.
I would say it's as if with Madoff, they were like, do we need a new category of investment products that are Ponzi's?
Yeah.
It's like... No, we don't, actually.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I mean, it's just totally, it's mind-boggling. And then I feel like it was easier, like, the media loves a villain like Madoff because he's, you know, a rich white Jewish man living in Palm Beach, Florida, stealing people's money to go buy cardigans at, you know, Brooks Brothers. Like, it's an easy target. Whereas for some reason with SBF, they don't, well, they don't see it that way.
Well, yeah, and now for I would even say that it's really easy to pile on afterwards, after everything's been revealed, and to throw tomatoes and kick him while he's on the ground and beat the dead horse.
Yeah.
And to me, like, the difficult part is before, how skeptical were you? So, like, same thing with, I would say it's the same between Madoff and SBF, of there was not enough skepticism.
No, there wasn't.
There were whistleblowers, and they were mocked, ridiculed, and ignored.
Yes.
And there was, you know, too little verification, too little auditing happening in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, everyone piles on of how evil this person was without recognizing their own complicit actions in this.
Yeah.
And without taking ownership of the lack of due diligence, the lack of auditing that preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is abhorrent. I was a skeptic of SBF for lots of different reasons. One of the reasons was that he didn't like Bitcoin very much.
Yeah, we don't really. We tend to be skeptical of people that don't like Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I'm like... That's why he should go to jail. The fraud. Let's forgive him on that. Yeah. But the truly unforgivable part was him not integrating Lightning at FTX.
I mean, he said sorry, so yeah.
But he has not apologized for hating on Bitcoin.
He has not said sorry for that.
Yeah. All right. On that note, we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. Any final words before we... kick this can till next month?
I feel like we're gonna continue to talk about this. I feel like he's the Craig Wright of crypto, right? This, and for those who don't know, Craig Wright is this guy who claimed to be Satoshi Nakamoto, is obviously a fraud, but is always in the news because he's constantly litigating and, you know, saying things that get him in the news. And so I think that both will continue to be a huge distraction, and we'll continue talking about it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, on that note, we will wish everyone a very Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year, Happy everything else that you celebrate. We will try to get you another episode in January. If you like the show, leave us a review. We do read them all. And I am doing interviews for my book that's coming out. It's a Bitcoin personal finance book. If you want to be interviewed, you should DM me on Twitter. I'm at Morgan with an E, Rochard, and Pierre is at Bitcoin Pierre. Sorry, I wanted to say your old one, but
yeah. See y'all on the internet.
Yeah.
And happy Thanksgiving too. You forgot that one, but we're after
it's Thanksgiving. After Thanksgiving. So yeah, but we happy Thanksgiving. Yeah. Hope you ate a lot of turkey.